Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Antioch University, New England, helping students change the world with graduate degrees in environmental studies, psychology, education, and management. antioch.edu/new-england.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. A bill that would allow parents to use state funding to pay private school tuition advances. Legislation that would legalize marijuana in the state is killed in committee, but the debate is far from over, and a special commission issues its recommendations on the future of Medicaid in New Hampshire. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them this hour, and we'd like you to lend your voice to the conversation. What about this week's news do you want to know? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Trent Spinner, executive editor of The Union Leader, and NHPR's online producer and reporter Dan Tuohy. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Good morning. Good morning, Peter.
And we're also live streaming a video of this radio broadcast. You can watch it live on our Facebook page. We're going to start the show talking about school choice, but like I said, we're also going to be talking about future of Medicaid, marijuana policy, Keno and Rochester also. Again, the phone number for you to lend your voice to this conversation, 1-800-892-6477. All right, we'll start with school choice. A bill that would allow New Hampshire parents to use state funding to send their children to private schools is closer to becoming law. Trent Spinner, what is this bill attempting to do?
So this would create education freedom savings accounts. That's what they're being called. Essentially, right now, what the state does is for every student in public school, they provide about $3,600. This law would allow parents to go to the state and say, hey, look, we don't want you to send that to, let's say, Manchester West High School, for example. We would prefer to get that approximately $3,600 and use that to pay for a private school, for a religious school, for homeschool supplies. Proponents of the bill say that this is perhaps the most expansive school choice proposal that would exist in the entire country. Opponents say that this would hurt public schools. It would deprive them of funding. This already passed in the Senate, and this was a House committee taking it up. This committee said it ought to pass by one vote, and the governor campaigned on this issue. So it is likely that he would sign something into law if this also passed the House.
Yeah, Governor Sununu was interested in sort of narrowing the qualifications for this, right?
That's right. So he wanted to add a couple of amendments, a couple of things like, for example, you had to be below 300% of the federal poverty level. But let's say you weren't under that number. If your child had an individual education plan, or if your child failed to gain public admission to a public charter school, you could get this money. So he just wanted to add a couple of qualifications to it.
Okay. And opponents say there's a constitutional concern here, since the state constitution says no person shall be compelled to pay to support a religious school. Dean, is that likely to trigger a lawsuit if the bill is eventually signed into law?
That would be my guess. These kinds of proposals have in the past in other contexts. The issue, the earlier discussion I remember with the Senate debate was about whether or not it should include religious schools. I think Frank Edelblue, the education commissioner, was in favor of including that and allowing it to be tested in the courts. They have this nonprofit scholarship organization that the money goes through, which some believe may mitigate that a little bit. But typically when you see public money going towards religious schools, it's going to trigger a constitutional challenge. So I would expect that that would be the case here as well.
Yeah, and we don't know really how many students we're talking about. If you read the bill, the most recent version, the estimates on what type of state funding would be involved here, we don't know. And that's something that's going to come up in early 2018 as well.
What's so interesting to me is that, you know, in an earlier incarnation, this would have been called a school voucher program. It was a very popular idea in the 1980s, the Reagan administration, the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, and then increasingly as you had Democratic presidents and Democratic Congress, and even a Democratic governor here in New Hampshire, it kind of receded from view. But with the advent of the Trump administration and Governor Sununu, Republican state legislature, Betsy DeVos, the conservative cabinet secretary for education, and also Frank Edelblue here in New Hampshire, education commissioner, all of that has helped kind of align for this type of legislation. And you see there were a number of groups, organizations that have pushed this for many years, and they seem to be almost kind of energized now because they see an opportunity for this sort of legislation. This would have been a non-starter for many years.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of money are we talking about here for a family that has a student that would qualify?
It's about, what, $3,000 or $3,600?
$3,600 per. But to Dan's point, we don't know how many people will take advantage of this, especially with the new qualifications of being below 300% of the federal poverty level or having some sort of individual education plan. The question is, how many people are going to take advantage of this?
Go ahead.
Well, I'll just say that, you know, the proponents say it's, you know, follow the money. The state money should follow the child. That's part of their argument for why this should go forward.
Yeah, and you also hear a discussion now about homeschooling, which was something in my recollection of the earlier debates in the 1980s and 90s. Homeschooling wasn't as much of a focus as it is now, and that's become part of the debate as well.
So what are the bill's prospects in the House now?
That's a good question. And that is the question, right? Whether or not this passes the House. It's already passed the Senate. The governor wants to sign some form of this bill. This passed out of committee by one vote. I would be surprised if it doesn't pass the entire House, but you never know with the House, right? There's a lot of horse trading that happens in the House. So I think this is a number one. This is a top priority for the governor. I think that he's been working on this a lot. But don't forget that there are going to be a lot of people who are opposed to this, even at this committee hearing. I mean, it's a pretty sleepy time at the State House right now, but we saw people outside this committee hearing protesting, which is pretty rare for this time of year.
And so we don't have a timeline exactly on when the House might do this?
Early
next year. Okay. So there were changes made to the original. So this is something that we're going to have to wait and see. But we do have a call on this subject. So let's go to Deb in Greenville. Deb, thank you very much for calling. What is your question or comment?
Actually, my concern is the lack of funding. We don't adequately fund our public education to begin with. Our district is a shared scenic school district. We have a lot of homeschooled children from our sharing town, New Ipswich. There will be a very direct impact financially should this bill pass, because the funding will go to the homeschoolers or to the religious. There's also a great number of religious-educated people in our district. And there will be no funding. It's going to come back to the towns to directly have to pay. I mean, it's the money has to come from somewhere, and if we're losing it for students in a public education setting, then we're going to have to come back at the taxpayers. I don't think people understand. I mean, we don't fund our education to begin with properly or adequately even. And
oh, Deb, did we lose you? I think we may have lost Deb. Thank you very much for calling, though, Deb. And that, to your last point, the proper funding of education. I mean, that sounds like this is a debate that we've been having in New Hampshire for a long time, right? Funding education adequately?
Well, Deb brings up a good point, which is that these education savings accounts are going to provide about $3,600. That's just one portion of what gets spent on educating a child. There are cities and towns that also have to contribute. I think in Manchester, we spend about $12,000 or $13,000 per student. Could be off a little bit on that. But so there's a balance due there for $10,000. So that money has to come from somewhere. It's likely going to come from parents who are going to have to support that. But I mean, that is the question. Where does this other money come from?
All right. Complicated debate. Let's put it aside for a moment because we've got some other stuff to talk about this today, including marijuana. A bill to legalize marijuana in New Hampshire was rejected by a House committee on Tuesday. House Bill 656 would have legalized the personal use of cannabis for people age 21 and older. And it also would have created a licensing system for businesses to sell marijuana. It would have been taxed by the state. This was nixed in committee. Maybe start with you, Dan. What were lawmakers concerned about with respect to legalizing marijuana for recreational use?
Well, there's also a concurrent study commission going on that will wrap up next year. That's what's a big part of it. It's one piece of the puzzle here. We do have medical marijuana. Just as early this year, we decriminalized marijuana for small possession of pot. Some people on the committee, it's a House Criminal Justice Committee. People are erring that New Hampshire's not ready for this. That's a big argument, whether or not you support the issue. And there's advocates for legalization to say, regardless of this committee vote, they're marching forward. When this recommendation comes to the full House in January or early in 2018, they're going to try to overturn that committee recommendation. And they say that marijuana should be treated like alcohol and regulated like alcohol.
And was this a party line issue, the way these people?
I don't have the breakdown, but it's not exactly a partisan issue. There's people on either side of the issue.
Mm-hmm. And was their decision surprising at all?
No, this was part of the debate that's evolving here. Like I said, there's a study commission that advocates for legalization already believe it's stacked with opponents. But we'll see. And, the governor, as we said before, he's not an advocate at this point for legalization.
Mm-hmm. You can kind of get a feeling for these sorts of issues if you spend enough time following politics in New Hampshire over many years, and it just feels like the political class in the state is not quite there yet. It took a long time to get medical marijuana through. The decriminalization legislation it came up in the House every year, passed, and then was always defeated in the Senate. We finally got that. I think what will make a difference is seeing Maine and Massachusetts ramp up their legalization programs. Massachusetts has had a lot of trouble implementing it thus far. Maine's got its own issues. I think that will kind of, how that goes will have an impact, I think, on how fast the debate moves in New Hampshire. But it just feels like, we may be surprised, but it just feels like sort of legislators are not quite there yet, and certainly the governor as well.
To your point, Dean, I think that's a good point. And what's been interesting to me is how much this conversation has shifted. One of the advocates, a proponent for legalization, Matt Simon from the Marijuana Policy Project, says that 68% of Granite Staters approve of legalization. Now, I don't know if that number is correct, but let's just use it to debate. It's interesting to see how from previous administrations, with Governor Lynch, Governor Hassan, and now to Governor Sununu, who agreed to decriminalize a very small amount of marijuana, how much this conversation has shifted, right? We always thought there's no way that this is anything like this will pass the Senate, which is pretty conservative. There's no way that something like this can happen. And then last year we saw that little piece of decriminalization. So I just wonder how much and that, the proponents for legalization say, this is a long-term game for us, right? We know that we may not get this passed this year, but it's just about keeping the pressure up on the political class.
And if you look at the data, there is clearly a sort of generational change going on in attitudes. In New Hampshire, people may not know this, has one of the oldest median ages of legislators in the country. I think it's about 62 or 63 years of age, and that's because it's essentially a volunteer legislature, so you tend to get people who are a little bit older who have the time and resources to volunteer. So I think you're going to see people get more comfortable seeing it in Maine and Massachusetts. You get a generational change, or younger people don't see it as big of an issue. You may get this sort of moment down the road where everything will come together, but it just feels like it's not quite there yet.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and later in this hour, we're going to be talking about Phillips Exeter Academy. State police reports from last year indicate that arrest warrants had been drafted for two Phillips Exeter Academy deans for allegedly not reporting instances of sexual abuse as is required by law. But the county attorney decided against criminal charges, and those deans remain on campus. Are you part of the Phillips Exeter community? If so, how do you feel about these revelations? Give us a call now to join us when that conversation starts. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Another important story in the news this week has to do with the future of Medicaid expansion. The future was discussed this week, and a commission looking at the future issued its final report calling for the program to be continued for at least another 5 years, but with major changes. Let's go to you, Trent, on this. What did the committee recommend?
Well, let's flash back to earlier this decade so that we can get some context of what happened here. After Obamacare passed, hospitals were still paying about $400 million a year in uncompensated care. So these are people who didn't have insurance but would still show up and they needed care. And hospitals were spending about $400 million a year on that. So the hospitals and legislators and the federal government, and I'm really simplifying this, but they all got together and they said, hey, there are about 50,000 people in the state who we can cover. The federal government said we'll put up about 95% of that cost. The hospitals said we'll cover the rest. And legislators said as long as this deal stays in place, we will continue this program. So that program, Medicaid expansion, started in 2015, 2016. It was expanded to cover another 2 years, including this year and next year. And the question now is what happens after that? So here's one of the things that everyone learned after all these new people, about 50,000 people, joined this Medicaid expansion program. They realized that these people were more expensive to cover, to care for, than some of the other people. They had more critical issues than people who are not part of this group. And so what happens right now is if you are eligible for Medicaid expansion, if you meet the certain income guidelines, the state will pay to cover a portion of your will cover your health insurance on the private marketplace. So you can go on healthcare.gov, you shop for a plan just like everyone else, but the state covers the cost of that. And what happened was that drove up the cost for everyone else on the private on the individual marketplace. So let's say you're not on a Medicaid expansion. The fact that people who are on Medicaid expansion were part of that group, that drove up the cost for everyone else to the tune of about 50%, for the record, for this upcoming year. I mean, there are people who are not on Medicaid expansion who are just shopping on the private marketplace whose premiums went up by 50% this year. I mean, to the tune of like tens of thousands of dollars a year. So what legislators would like to do now is remove those people off the private marketplace and instead pay someone to manage their care. So very similar to a managed Medicaid program. That's what they would like to do for these people, and they think that'll drive down costs.
Okay. What's interesting though about this is if you remember back to the original Medicaid expansion debate here in New Hampshire, Republicans wanted market-driven solution. So they wanted the money for the Medicaid expansion to be given to individuals to buy on the exchange rather than go straight to managed care like the existing program. And interestingly enough, you're suggesting that actually increased premiums as a result.
And we heard also this week from Republican Senator Sharon Carson of Londonderry. She was among those who supported the recommendation to move the state's Medicaid expansion program closer to a managed care model, even though she has opposed Medicaid expansion in the past.
I think this was a good work product, and it addressed the problems in the plan. And I think it's important that we talk about those problems before we reauthorize anything.
That's Republican Senator Sharon Carson. So complicated situation, a lot of moving parts. Has Governor Sununu weighed in on this at all?
Not that I'm aware of, but this does, this was just an early committee meeting, and the commission chairman, Senator Jeb Bradley, a Republican from Wolfboro, his quote to Dave Solomon, the union leader, State House bureau chief, was, we got to first base, and that's a good place to be, but there's a long way to go, he says. So I think that's true. I think that there are a lot of moving pieces here.
Mm-hmm. And also with respect to Medicaid expansion, Governor Sununu says, the state would withdraw from Medicaid expansion if the state can't impose a work requirement on people who receive Medicaid. That's assuming, of course, the Trump administration approves such a work requirement. Likely that he will, you think, Dan?
We don't know. I mean, there's so many questions here. It's really touch and go. And with, the governor and his staff have communicated with the White House in terms of what is coming down the pike. And I don't think the White House really knows at this point, given their attempts to repeal and replace Obamacare. So that's one of those TBA questions to be announced in 2018.
The White House has said, Trump has said, yes, we want to add this work requirement. Trump wants to do that. The question is whether the federal law will allow him to do it.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, if you've got questions about the week's news, something the press didn't catch, please let us know. Coming up, we're going to talk with reporter Hadley Barndollar about how sexual assault allegations were handled at Phillips Exeter Academy. We'll also be talking about other stories having to do with sexual misconduct in this hour. You can weigh in with your thoughts. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page if you'd like, where we've got a live stream of this broadcast happening right now. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
Whether you're looking for a good read or want to learn how to write one, NHPR's podcasts have got you covered.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about those moments and how you saw them fitting into the book.
Well, I don't think it's...
Do you edit as you're going along, or do you tend to write it all out and then go back and edit at the end?
At the very beginning, when I started...
Subscribe to The Bookshelf, 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, and all NHPR's podcasts on iTunes and Google Play.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. It's been a busy week for reporters in New Hampshire. Now is your chance to get some answers to your questions about what's been happening in the Granite State. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking about a variety of stories having to do with sexual misconduct, both here in New Hampshire and across the country and in D.C. Call us now. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And on the line with us now is Hadley Barndollar, reporter for the Portsmouth Herald and Exeter Newsletter. And she's here to talk to me about Phillips Exeter. Hadley, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, everybody. I was looking forward to it.
We're glad to have you here. And the story you've been reporting on has to do with state police reports from last year, which indicate that arrest warrants had been drafted for two Phillips Exeter Academy deans for allegedly not reporting instances of sexual abuse, which is required by law. The county attorney decided against criminal charges. Those deans remain on campus. So, Hadley, take us back to the incident that would eventually lead to these arrest warrants being drawn up. What do we know about what happened?
So this actually goes back to 2015 and was probably the story that gained the most media attention for the Academy. This case went back to October 2015, where a Academy senior at the time, Chuck Woody Ikepizu, was accused of fondling another student against her will in the basement of the church. And a lot of people will know of this as the bread baking case, because allegedly the school's reverend came up with some kind of compromise between the two to kind of heal any damage that had been done. And this actually got a lot of coverage by the Boston Globe, because the victim spoke to the Globe about her struggle in trying to report this alleged assault to administrators, who characterized it as harassment rather than assault. And she met with these two deans, A.J. Cosgrove and Melissa Mischke, I believe it was on two occasions, outlining what had happened to her. And allegedly, they never reported this suspected abuse. And this is kind of what led us to these jarring state police reports that were released to various media sources this week.
Mm-hmm. And why do these deans say that they made the decision not to report these?
So they came out with a joint statement Tuesday evening saying that over their careers as deans at the school, they have and have continued to report it, suspected child abuse, but that they believed, quote-unquote, in good faith, that had not occurred in this situation. And they defended their decision and said that, you know, if they had believed, you know, some abuse had occurred, that they would, in fact, had reported it to the state.
Is the school backing them up on that statement?
Yes, absolutely. And this is something interesting to note, is the Trooper report, and the Union Leader wrote a story on this, I believe it was yesterday, is kind of at odds with what the Academy is saying. The Trooper report said that the two deans did not agree to be interviewed by investigators, and they actually never spoke to anyone in the state police about their involvement with this case. But the school, in their statement released on Tuesday, kind of detailed that, yes, you know, the deans did cooperate. They lent all the information they had. Their lawyers worked with the state police. So we kind of have two contradicting accounts of what happened within this investigation.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know about why prosecutors decided not to execute these arrest warrants and arrest these deans?
I think what's really interesting here is when I talked to Pat Conway, Rockingham County Attorney, this week, she used the word that instead of deciding to pursue criminal charges against the deans. Alternatively, her office entered into a memorandum of understanding with the academy and the police department, which basically outlines for all academy faculty and staff the obligation to report any suspected child abuse on campus. And it's a very multifaceted memorandum. It includes sexual assault survivor counseling, services. So Conway's reasoning was that they didn't pursue these criminal charges because there wasn't enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That was one thing she emphasized, was that there's a big difference between probable cause and proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
This might be an appropriate point in the conversation to bring in a clip we have from attorney Peter Hutchins, who has represented victims of sexual assault in some high schools. Here he is discussing the state's mandatory reporting law under the Child Protection Act.
When they have reason to suspect that sexual assault or sexual misconduct has taken place involving a minor, then they must report it to law enforcement officials. The rub comes, though, when you're trying to charge someone criminally for violating this statute, that in order to violate the criminal law, which is endangering the welfare of a child, it must be proven that the individual knowingly endangered the child by purposely violating this duty. So they may have had a duty in hindsight and had reason to suspect abuse, and they should have reported. But the criminal issue becomes, did they knowingly endanger the child by purposely violating that law?
So, Hadley, we might be able to infer from this that the prosecutor simply did not believe that they could prove that.
Absolutely, and that's the tricky part here.
Okay, so what is the, we've been saying in these reports that, okay, these deans are still on campus. Is there a sense among some in the Phillips-Exeter community that these deans should not be on campus now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the most jarring thing to much of the Exeter community about this was that arrest warrants were actually drafted for these two deans. So that was a whole step that was taken to charge both these deans with a misdemeanor crime. One of the big themes, like the last 2 years, has been that the academy has to unburden themselves from these years and years of alleged sexual misconduct. And, a bone of contention for quite a few of alumni are these two deans who are alleged to have been part of an effort to, in some way, stifle a student from reporting an alleged sexual assault. They're still on campus, and that is keeping that kind of situation alive and well on campus, is what some alumni are saying.
We have a comment from Barbara from Portsmouth who wrote into the exchange to say, it's a little lengthy, but I'll read it. I'm an alum of Phillips Exeter Academy and also taught there from 1994 to 2004, and these two deans were colleagues. These deans are decent people. The bigger problem, according to Barbara from Portsmouth, was and apparently is still a culture that not just fostered insular decision-making, but trained faculty incorrectly. While a faculty member, I attended official faculty training with the Academy's lawyer in which we were made aware of reporting laws, but were instructed to speak to a school administrator first. This is obviously not the legal and proper procedure. Barbara concludes, I hope PEA is being honest in statements of transparency and outreach moving forward. Hadley, in your reporting on Phillips Exeter, has training ever come up?
Actually, training has come up within the last several months since this MOU was signed with the Rockingham County Attorney's Office. Pat Conway says that the plan is to annually engage all faculty and staff with training with her office regarding the mandated reporting law. Prior to that, I can't say I'm quite sure what training that these faculty and staff went through, but it's obvious that going forward, they're making a real effort there.
Well, Barbara from Portsmouth, thank you very much for weighing in. And Hadley Barndollar of the Portsmouth Herald and Exeter Newsletter, thank you very much for joining us and illuminating the story.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've been speaking about sexual assault allegations and how they were handled at Phillips Exeter. Unfortunately, that it's not just limited to that school. It's been happening in a variety of locations. I'm here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, Trent Spinner, and Dan Tuohy. We're talking about the week's news, and among the stories this week was a story about Dartmouth College. A former Dartmouth professor says she reported an incident of sexual harassment involving Todd Heatherton to the college about 15 years ago. That's raising questions about Dartmouth's handling of misconduct complaints. Heatherton is one of three professors now under criminal investigation. Dan Tuohy, I want to turn this to you because NHPR has been reporting on this a lot. What's happening with these three professors? Bring us up to speed on that story.
Sure. They are still under investigation. You know, the Attorney General's office is contributing not in conjunction with the college, of course. We don't really know where this investigation is proceeding at the point. But yeah, as Brita Green reported for NHPR this week, this former professor had a colleague share on Facebook a letter that she wrote about these allegations from 2002, so 15 years ago. And she's bringing up similar to the Phillips Exeter case, reporting. Why wasn't these allegations reported in 2002? And that's an issue that's coming up here in Dartmouth as well.
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead, Dean.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's interesting. You know, there's been kind of such a limit in terms of information on this that Todd Heatherton is really the only one that we're hearing about at this point, which is what this particular former professor, Jennifer Groh, was referring to. And I just read a report this morning that another colleague says that he groped her at a conference a number of years ago. So this is sort of, we're kind of peeling back the onion here, but we don't really know a lot about what's going on with the other two professors. We have not been given an overview. And, I think that we're seeing, whether it's prep schools or private universities, people now kind of looking back on standard operating procedures or the culture of how you report these things. And I think across the board, people are finding it insufficient. And it's part of the larger conversation we're having now about sexual harassment and sexual assault. And, you hope something good is going to come from it. But it's just amazing to see all the things that are kind of floating up now from 10, 15, 20 years ago.
And Trent, is Dartmouth College responding more broadly to the issue of sexual assault, not just because of this case, but for any other reason?
They are. The president reached out to the entire community to say that, we're looking at the way we do things. And to Dean's point, I think that there was this culture, this thought, especially among these private schools, that if there's a groping incident, if there's a sexual assault incident, that they can talk about that as a part of the educational process rather than calling the police. And that is at odds with not only what people think now, but also some state laws. In the Dartmouth case, the original the statement from Dartmouth was, we wanted to investigate this but maintain everyone's privacy. And the Attorney General's office said, hey, wait a second here. They don't have a right to privacy. This could potentially be criminal conduct and needs to be investigated.
Mm-hmm. Let's pull back the camera a little bit and talk about how this is happening in other parts of the country, particularly this week. Most recently this week, Senator Al Franken of Minnesota was accused of forcefully kissing TV and radio host Leanne Tweeden in 2006. He also took an inappropriate photo with her while she was sleeping, and that has really gone viral. He has apologized, but it's not looking good for him. What are Democratic Senators Jean Shaheen and Maggie Hassan saying about it, Trent?
Jean Shaheen is part of this committee, this ethics committee that would look into this. Senate leadership has said that they think there should be an ethics committee investigation, and Shaheen's on it, so she can't say anything about it. Senator Hassan has said that she thinks that there should be a committee investigation. So we'll see if that happens and how long that takes.
And Senator Franken has been very willing to cooperate with the ethics committee. What typically happens with these committees is they can come up with a range of punishments from to doing nothing or a censure to, in theory, expelling a senator from the Senate. That rarely happens. The only recent example would be Bob Packwood, who resigned when it seemed like he might be thrown out for misconduct. So, we'll see what comes of it. But it is very, people are, some particularly Republicans, but some folks are calling for Senator Franken to resign. Maybe he'll do that, but the likelihood that the Senate will actually vote to expel him, I think, is pretty low at the moment.
Meanwhile, Congresswoman Annie Custer, herself a victim of sexual assault, has proposed bipartisan legislation aimed at reducing sexual assault and harassment in Congress. And she discussed with Morning Edition host Rick Ganley just how prevalent this problem has been.
One of the most shocking aspects of this that we've discovered is that there have been harassment, sexual harassment settlements made by the United States Congress about specific members of Congress, but that information has not become public. And furthermore, the taxpayers have been paying those settlements unbeknownst to their constituents or their colleagues.
That's incredible. That's an incredible revelation,
right,
Trent.
Right. And don't forget, Representative Custer, who a Democrat from Hopkinton, has her own powerful story where she was sexually assaulted in a meeting when she was on a young staffer on the Hill. This bill would essentially require mandatory annual training for staff members, both members of Congress and their staff, about sexual assault and what to do and how to report it, and also implement surveys where they would see how prevalent this issue is.
And earlier this week, again on sexual misconduct and how parties are handling it, former GOP chairwoman in New Hampshire, Jennifer Horn, argued that Republicans need to hold themselves to a higher standard than the Democrats hold themselves when it comes to sexual misconduct. She was writing in the Union Leader. I reached out to Horn this week for comment, but she did not respond. But I did have questions about, the party approach to this. I mean, because maybe I'll talk to you about this, Dean. I mean, both parties seem to not have great records here.
Yeah.
It's hard to sort of make a case that one party is morally superior to the other with respect to sexual assault.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a problem that everyone is grappling with, both Republicans and Democrats. You know, for Republicans, most of the response to the Roy Moore, the running for Senate in Alabama, most of the response to that has been, well, what about Bill Clinton? They now have switched over to, well, what about Al Franken? But nonetheless, you know, both parties are struggling with it. The reality is, there's been a lot of talk about how the Clintons demonized the victims in a way that just, you know, think about what Monica Lewinsky has gone through. It's just unbelievable. That would not be acceptable today. But the reality was that was a different time, a different conversation, a different way of dealing with it. It's always a lot tougher when it's somebody from your own party and you have to make trade-offs. But I think the conversation now is much healthier. But I think people are trying to figure out, you know, how do you strike a balance between, complete silence and trying people on Twitter before we know what all the facts are. So I think everyone is trying to figure out where we are in between. And there's just a danger of it being politicized. It's nice whenever you see, whether it's Roy Moore or Al Franken, when you see members of each party kind of step out of their partisan roles and just say this is wrong, regardless of what the implications may be. It may be the case that the Republicans lose a Republican vote from Alabama for the first time in many, many, many years if the Democrat actually wins that Senate seat. But you are actually seeing some Republicans in the Senate say they would be okay with that, because that's just sort of the reality of the situation. So, yeah, it's politicized. You get a lot of whataboutism and finger pointing. But I think the conversation today is much healthier and much more, I think, optimistic than what we dealt with, 25 years ago with the Clintons. And going back to JFK, you know, that was just a different time in terms of how the media covered the presidency. You could never, that would not have been able to have been kept secret back then, now.
Yeah, it is interesting to see that, you know, there are some Republicans who are asking Roy Moore to drop out of the race. And there are some Democrats saying Al Franken should just resign, just to stop drawing the Republican fire about this. A complicated situation for sure, and certainly regrettable for any of the victims to have to go through any of this. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. And with you, we've got more news to discuss this hour. We hope that you will join us for that conversation. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. We're going to be talking about the race for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st District, talk about changes to gun laws in the wake of the shooting in Texas. The Claremont Needle Exchange Program has to shut down. Talk about Coakley Landfill, and also the trial of Christina Fey and her Great Danes. That's all coming up on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Again, the phone number 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with NHPR's Dan Tuohy, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliota, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Call us with your questions about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, email 1-800-892-NHPR. Email, if you'd like to write us an email, is exchange@nhpr.org. All right, let's talk about the race for what's going to be an open seat in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. The news this week out of that race is that Mindy Mesmer is now running. She's running to possibly replace Democrat Carol Shea Porter. She says she's not running for re-election. So let's go to you, Trent, on this. Who is Mindy Mesmer?
Good question. Let me pass that to Dean. Right, Dean. We were just talking about this before. I'm having trouble keeping track of all these different races.
Forgive me for firing that question at you.
It's very confusing.
We should also mention that this race is growing and growing and growing.
It's changing every day.
We've got like six Democrats and two Republicans, and sure. Mindy Mesmer is one of the Democrats,
recent,
right?
Right, and she's, I believe, a new member of the State House of Representatives, has been very involved in environmental and health issues on the Sea Coast. She's one of the individuals who's been closely involved with the debate over the pediatric cancer cluster on the Sea Coast. She's running. Chris Pappas has gotten in the race, the executive counselor from the Manchester area since the last time we were here. He had sort of been viewed as kind of a front runner. I think I've mentioned before that back in 2016, the DNC was sort of quietly trying to get him to challenge Carol Shea Porter in a primary. He decided not to. He's in this time. Terrence O'Rourke, Rochester City Attorney, Mark McKenzie, a longtime former leader of the AFL-CIO here, Morris Sullivan, a Marine, a former Obama administration official, and Lincoln Soldati, the former Stafford County attorney. So you got six Democrats vying for this open seat. On the Republican side, we only have two right now, Andy Sanborn, conservative member of the state Senate, and Eddie Edwards is a former liquor enforcement official, also conservative. So it's interesting. I expected more Republicans, but we sure are getting a lot of Democrats.
Wow. Okay. Easy to make a choice then, right?
Well, it's really interesting. You're going to see if all these candidates stay on the ballot or make the ballot, here we are in November of 2017, it'll split the Democratic primary vote in some various different ways. And it'll be about ground game and maybe a little bit of luck. You know, it'll be something to watch.
Well, I mean, the you just mentioned, Dean, that the party was sort of pushing for Chris Pappas a few years ago. Is he sort of the party favorite now, Dan, do you think? Or
of the six, I think he's probably the best, most well-known. He's obviously every candidate in the New Hampshire primary stops by his family restaurant, the Puritan Backroom there in Manchester, Republicans and Democrats. And I have a couple of photographs with Chris Pappas hanging out with Dr. Ben Carson. So, I mean, it's one of those things where, restaurants and hospitality—it's nonpartisan. So he's met a lot of people in that venue.
Food is nonpartisan. Okay, if he's not running for executive council again, which is going to open up that seat, and there was some speculation, maybe we can put this to bed right now, that Ted Gatzis, who lost re-election campaign for mayor in Manchester, would run for executive council. Trent, is he going
to
do it?
I put that question to a very close source, someone very close to Ted Gatzis, and the source laughed. So, not saying anything's impossible, but I think he's still pretty focused on closing out his term as mayor.
Okay, so not preparing a run, although he has been known to run for other positions while
he has
mayor.
Represented Manchester in some way or another since the year 2000, for almost 17 years now.
And there's precedent there. Raymond J. Wazurek, the former Manchester mayor and one-time congressional candidate, was an executive counselor for District 4.
Okay. So. Well, all right. We'll see what happens with that seat. Anyway, a bipartisan group of senators in Washington has struck a deal to bolster a federal database used to check backgrounds of gun buyers in the aftermath of several recent mass shootings. Senator Gene Shaheen was part of this effort. What would this law do?
It's trying to toughen up the database for background checks and the NICS. It's the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. And really, Shaheen's been on this issue for a couple of years now. And this bill is interesting because it has bipartisan sponsorship. The majority whip from Texas is one of the main sponsors. And it's really one of those things where they want to make sure that people that shouldn't have guns don't get them, which is, as we know, it's one of those things where people who are Second Amendment advocates say let's not have new laws, let's improve the ones we have on the books.
Okay. And safe to say that this is partly in response to the shooting in Texas that killed more than 2 dozen people, including children and infants.
I think Texas and in Northern California as well. The gentleman there, the murderer in this case, had obtained his firearms illegally.
Well, he built his own, right? The guy in California, he constructed them, whereas the shooter in Texas, as far as I understand it, acquired them even though he had criminal convictions that should have been reported to the database, right? I mean, so...
And that was the Air Force dropped the ball on that, I believe.
Yeah, the Air Force.
Report the information.
So, all right, so is this actually a bipartisan piece of gun legislation that'll make it through, Dean?
Well, it's a bipartisan piece of gun legislation. I've learned, certainly in the wake of Newtown and the more recent tragedies that we had, that just when you think there's finally some small thing that everybody can agree on that may make a change, it still just it gets bogged down. I mean, we're still what happened to bump stocks? And we have, one or two states that have maybe banned them, but, you know, there was all this talk about something being done on that, and nothing happened. So I'm just sort of by definition pessimistic about even bipartisan gun legislation at this point. But, you know, maybe we'll be surprised.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guests about the week's news. Still time for you to give us a call if you've got something to say. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, or pound out an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about this needle exchange program in Claremont. It was the state's first, and now it's closed. We'll go to you, Trent, on this. Where was the needle exchange program in Claremont?
This was in Claremont. It was near a school, and that was the issue. This started back in June. A couple of medical school students from the Dartmouth Medical School said, we'd like to open this program because, there's been research that shows that if you can't get someone off of heroin or injectable drugs, if you can at least get them a clean needle, there's a lower chance of spreading diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. So this was the state's first needle exchange program. There was a lot of discussion about it. I think that's a nice way of putting it, when it started. And people asked for the town to look at a different place, a place to move it away from a school, and the town agreed.
Mm-hmm. Was it working? Do we know if it was working?
I don't know if it was working. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many people used it. I don't have that info.
And was it the only, it was the state's first, was it the state's only?
It was.
Oh, okay. But they're looking for an alternate location as far as I understand, right?
They are.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a story we'll have to keep following. We've got a few more stories to talk about before the end of the hour, one of which is Coakley state and federal environmental officials held a meeting in Northampton on Wednesday night to update residents on efforts to address contamination at the former Coakley landfill site. Dan, what were residents told about contamination there?
Well, residents were the officials were trying to placate, if they could, concerns that there was contamination and it was affecting the health of the area, or people who live in the area. After the meeting, as Jason Moon reported for NHPR, I don't think people in that area believe it, or they're not satisfied. They still want more research done on what health impacts the Coakley landfill has in store. And the Coakley landfill is located not far from Route 1 in Portsmouth and on the Northampton town line. So it's not exactly a landfill that's out in the middle of nowhere. It's near some residential areas and some commercial areas.
And does this have any connection, allegedly or actually, to what we've been hearing regarding a cancer cluster?
I don't think there's been a known connection or nexus there.
Yeah, this is a little different. I think the EPA is saying here that there's no short-term risk, but that they need to continue to do more studying, which I think is some people don't find particularly comforting, that they don't really know for sure. But yeah, these are the perfluorochemicals at PFCs. This landfill has been closed, as I understand it, for decades, and it's just sort of detecting this problem now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's more research for the EPA.
Yes, it sounds like they're going to continue to study it, but they've said no short-term risk, according to the EPA.
And there's certainly a very vocal group out there who think that there is a risk, who think that the cancer cluster is related. They don't want to wait for more scientific research. They want something done about it now, and they have the ear of a lot of elected officials.
Mm-hmm. Which elected officials do you know?
Some of our federal delegation members are actually asking the EPA are actually looking to add some money to the budget to get this study moving a lot faster.
Yeah, I mean, it's a federal Superfund site, so it's part of that program, cleanup program.
Okay. Let's talk about Christina Fey. Christina Fey took the stand in Ospe District Court to defend herself against charges of animal cruelty. That's after 75 Great Danes were taken from her Wolfboro mansion earlier this year. Many of those dogs were in terrible shape. Some, unfortunately, have died since then. Dean, when she took the stand this week, what was her defense? What was her explanation?
Well, it was interesting. Very interesting strategy. You know, a couple of the arguments she made was that, you know, part of the problem was that her neighbors were not very friendly, so she couldn't let the dogs out very often. You know, she sort of indirectly blamed the town of Wolfboro for not being particularly welcoming. And so she made both of those arguments and then also said that, you know, she would never mistreat these dogs. They're her life. They're her reason for being. But, you know, the judge is going to get to make the ultimate decision here. I still, you know, as I've said many times before on the show, I'm a longtime dog owner for decades. I've adopted from shelters. I've purchased dogs from breeders. I understand that whole world really well. And I just do not understand how what we saw happened if, in fact, she was a good or a careful breeder. I think the use of the word breeder is wrong because breeders don't keep 75 to 80 dogs in their house. That's not how operations typically work. And they typically don't talk about their dogs in the way that she did as their reason for being their whole life. I mean, that sounds like a hoarder, an animal hoarder to me. But I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a longtime dog owner who understands sort of how this world works pretty well.
She took the defense on her own, the stand in her own defense, and it was pretty passionate about her love for these animals. But, you know, some of the jaw-dropping statements she made about spending $25,000 a month for their upkeep and serving them the highest quality food and yet giving them McDonald's hamburgers as a treat. A lot of things that were, like, if you're in the courtroom and reading some of the press out of there, including our own here at NHPR, it was a lot of head scratching going on.
Blaming the neighbors and Wolfboro, sure, I think, was just
sure.
Unfortunate.
She's obviously wealthy, living in a mansion, and all these things that you look at, like, well, what really happened here? And these animals and the investigators that also testified at trial, talking about the squalid conditions of this house, is just, you know, it's amazing. And that's one of those headlines that has really gotten international attention to the story.
Mm-hmm. And understandable. I think actually the quote of the week came out of that court case. So one of our reporters was at the trial, and he reported back that one of her quotes was that these dogs were the Van Goghs and Rembrandts of the canine world. And that, to me, really kind of put things in perspective.
Mm-hmm. And let's hear a little bit of what she had to say for herself when she was in court.
They are literally my reason for living. They are my joy. They are my solace. They are my family. And they are all that I care to have in my life in this final chapter.
So that's Christina Fey speaking in Ossipee District Court about the dogs that were removed from her home when she was accused of animal cruelty. So it's in the judge's hands now, Dean.
Yeah, and that was exactly the quote I was referring to. I've never heard a commercial breeder talk like that about their animals before. It just sounds like there's something a little different going on there. But yes, for everything we've discussed, this is going to go to the judge. It's a bench trial. There's no jury. And she's facing some pretty serious charges. But, you know, she seems to be mainly concerned about getting her dogs back. I don't know that that's going to happen, but that seems to be her focus.
Okay. Last story we have time for today has to do with the vote on Keno in Rochester. Last week, voters went to the polls, as voters in some cities did, to decide whether or not they want Keno in their borders. And Rochester, every vote really seemed to count in Rochester, right? Rochester approved Keno by a single vote. But Trent, seems like there's likely to be a recount.
There is. That was actually on election night. That was one of our stop the presses moment because we had in a big headline, Rochester doesn't pass Keno. They had flipped two numbers in the results. And when you actually flipped them back and got them correct, we found it passed by. We thought it failed. It actually, and our original headline said that, but then we figured out that they had flipped the numbers, and it passed by one vote. And a number of state reps are looking to get the signatures necessary. And I think they only needed 20, so I would imagine they have that by now.
The deadline's today, I think.
Yeah, I would imagine they were able to find 20 people in Rochester to ask for a recount. So there will be a recount, most likely a recount in Rochester. And I think 7 of the 10 cities that voted on Election Day past Keno. Franklin had already voted for it. Either way, it looks like we're going to have Keno by Christmas, at least in some cities in New Hampshire.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I always tell my students that if they really want to have an impact, vote in local elections, because most people vote in presidential elections when you've got over 100 million people voting and your individual vote is a lot less likely to have an impact. But you can make a real difference in a mayoral election or a city council election or some sort of initiative in your town. So it's always interesting to me that when you could have the biggest impact, in this case, one vote difference, people are least likely to turn out to vote.
Well, let that be a lesson to anyone thinking of going out to vote on town meeting day, right? Because that's when the towns decide, right? Okay. And then, of course, the 2018 midterms. But still, regarding Keno, last thing is that a couple of the representatives in Rochester are thinking of introducing legislation that would repeal the Keno thing in the first place, right? Is that likely to happen? I mean, what would happen to kindergarten funding if that happened?
I don't think it's likely at this point. As Trent mentioned, I mean, the New Hampshire Lottery is rolling out with these games in mid-December. And this is going to be, I think it's going to spread, it's already spreading. Manchester businesses already have numerous applications, apparently, for a Keno license.
So, yeah, probably gonna stay a thing here in New Hampshire, Keno. All right. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being on the show today. We've got Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. Thank you very much for being here and sharing your thoughts about the week's news.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. And remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
Expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.